This CLE course is based on the appellate decisions addressing issues related to negligence that were released by our appellate courts in November of 2019. The summaries that make up this CLE were initially posted on the New York Appellate Digest website in November of 2019, and they've since been compiled into a monthly update pamphlet. And it's that November 2019 negligence update pamphlet which serves as the written materials for this course, and the page references are to that pamphlet. The first case is Fawcett versus Turner Construction Company on page 7, and the issue there is whether a bankruptcy trustee can be substituted for a plaintiff in a personal injury action where the plaintiff did not list the personal injury action as an asset. Second Department held the bankruptcy trustee was properly substituted by the bankruptcy court for plaintiff in a personal injury action, despite the fact that the action had not been listed as an asset when plaintiff filed a voluntary petition for Chapter 7 bankruptcy. The court said, "The rule that a substitution cannot be made is grounded in Reynolds versus Blue Cross of Northeastern New York, 210-82-619. In that case, the plaintiffs commenced an action against the defendants to recover damages for personal injuries. Thereafter, the plaintiffs filed a voluntary petition for Chapter 7 bankruptcy and failed to list the action on the schedule of assets. The Appellate Division, 3rd Department, determined that substitution was not available to cure the deficiency on the ground that a party with no capacity to sue could not be replaced with one who had the capacity to sue. Although cases have held that a substitution of the bankruptcy trustee for the plaintiff cannot be made even if the plaintiff had the capacity to sue at the time the action or proceeding was commenced, other cases have held that where a motion for substitution was made at the direction of a bankruptcy court, the motion should be granted as a matter of comity. As a matter of comity, and in deference to the determination of the bankruptcy court, we agree with the Supreme Court's determination to grant the plaintiff's cross motion to substitute the bankruptcy trustee as the plaintiff and to deny the defendant's motion for leave to amend their answer to assert the affirmative defense of lack of capacity to sue and thereupon to dismiss the complaint. Next is Gang versus State of New York on page 8. It's a court of claims action, a medical malpractice action brought by an inmate who had hip replacement surgery, and it deals with the continuous treatment toll of the statute of limitations in the context of filing a notice of intent in the court of claims. Fourth Department, reversing the court of claims, held that the notice of intent was timely, and the notice of intent and the claim are not jurisdictionally defective in this medical malpractice action. The claimant was an inmate when he underwent hip replacement surgery. The claim alleged inadequate treatment led to infection requiring further surgeries. The date of the accrual of the action was told by the continuous treatment doctrine. The court wrote, "Generally, a medical malpractice claim accrues on the date of the alleged malpractice, but the statute of limitations is tolled until the end of the course of continuous treatment. That toll likewise applies to the time periods contained in Court of Claims Act, Section 10, Subdivision 3. Here, the record establishes that claimant was receiving ongoing treatment for his left hip replacement during post-operative follow-up visits through June 12, 2014, when he was transported to a hospital for treatment of the infection that developed at the incision site, which had not been diagnosed during those follow-up visits. We thus conclude that the notice of intent, filed and served on August 22, 2014, was timely inasmuch as it was filed and served within 90 days of the accrual of the claim." The court went on, "We recognize that generally the failure to treat a condition is not considered continuous treatment so as to toll the statute of limitations. In such cases, however, there is a lack of awareness of the need for further treatment and thus no concern relating to the interruption of corrective medical treatment. Here, claimant was already being treated for the surgical incision that eventually became infected, and therefore further treatment was explicitly anticipated by both defendant's medical staff and claimant, as manifested in the form of regularly scheduled appointments to monitor the incision and remove the staples. Next is Payne versus Rome Memorial Hospital on page 10. It's a danger invites rescue case. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held there was a question of fact whether the danger invites rescue doctrine applied. One of defendant's employees tried to use a Hoyer lift to transfer the patient plaintiff was accompanying from a wheelchair to a bed. The lift began to tip over, and plaintiff allegedly hurt her back trying to prevent the patient from falling. The court wrote, "The court erred in granting the motion with respect to the claim for negligence based on the danger invites rescue doctrine, and we therefore modify the order. That doctrine imposes liability upon a party who, by his or her culpable act, has placed another person in a position of imminent peril, which invites a third person, the rescuing plaintiff, to come to his or her aid, on the ground that the wrong that imperils life is a wrong to the imperiled victim, and also to his or her rescuer. For the rescue doctrine to apply, it is sufficient that the plaintiff held a reasonable belief of imminent peril of serious injury to another, and it matters not that the peril feared did not materialize. In support of its motion, defendant submitted plaintiff's deposition testimony, where she testified that she informed defendant's employee that two people were needed to move the patient onto the bed using the Hoyer lift. But the employee insisted on using the lift alone, and did so in a manner that caused the lift to tilt, which in turn caused the patient to begin to fall off of it. We conclude that the evidence submitted by defendant in support of its motion failed to establish that plaintiff's rescue efforts were unreasonable as a matter of law, or that plaintiff's actions were so rash under the circumstances as to constitute an intervening and superseding cause of her alleged injuries. Next is ITK versus Nassau BOCES on page 11. It has to do with the sufficiency of the notice of claim. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that that plaintiff student could not proceed based upon a theory that was not included in the notice of claim. Plaintiff, who alleged she was sexually assaulted at the BOCES facility, did not allege in her notice of claim that the school district, which did not have custody of her when she was assaulted, was also liable because it had formulated an individualized education program for her. The court noted that the issue, although raised for the first time on appeal, could be considered because it was a question of law that could not have been avoided by the lower court. The court wrote, "The plaintiff may not proceed under the theory that the school district, North Shore, negligently failed to formulate an appropriate individualized education program for her, as the plaintiff did not include this theory in her notice of claim. And although the school district did not raise this argument before Supreme Court, we may consider it because it presents an issue of law that appears on the face of the record and could not have been avoided had it been raised at the proper time." Next is Ninivaggi versus County of Nassau on page 12. It's an assumption of the risk case. Second Department, over an extensive dissent, held that the primary assumption of risk doctrine applied to a 14-year-old experienced football player who was injured by stepping into a 2 to 5 inch depression on a school athletic field. The majority distinguished the condition here, which was part of the natural features of a grass field, and a condition resulting from disrepair. The court said, "The plaintiffs described the grass field on which the accident occurred as choppy, wavy, and bumpy, with several depressions. In other words, the topography of the grass field on which the infant plaintiff was playing was irregular. The risks posed by playing on that irregular surface were inherent in the activity of playing football on a grass field. Moreover, the infant plaintiff's testimony demonstrated that he was aware of and appreciated the inherent risks, and that the irregular condition of the field was not concealed. Next is Calderon versus College on page 13, another assumption of the risk case. Second Department held that plaintiff, a college soccer player, assumed the risk of injury caused by being struck in the head by the soccer ball. The court said, the evidence demonstrated that the defendants had no reason to believe that the plaintiff had sustained a concussion and that the plaintiff assumed the risks of any injuries to his head or brain stemming from being hit in the head by a soccer ball during the course of play by voluntarily participating in the soccer match. Next is Estrella versus Fujitec. It's on page 15. It's an elevator case, elevator injury case, and the issue is whether the injury was foreseeable. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiffs jumping out of a stalled elevator was an unforeseeable consequence of the elevator malfunction. The court said, plaintiff was injured when she attempted to exit a service elevator in the building where she worked after the elevator stalled near the top floor of the building. A co-worker testified that the elevator shook and the lights went out for a few seconds. Plaintiff testified that she used the intercom in the elevator to contact the building's doorman, who said he would call the elevator mechanic. A few minutes later, another co-worker, who was also in the stalled elevator, pried the door open. Plaintiff saw that the elevator was about 2.5 feet above the floor level and decided to jump out, believing she could do so safely. Under these circumstances, plaintiff's act of jumping from the stalled elevator was an unforeseeable, superseding cause of her accident, which terminates any potential liability of defendant elevator maintenance company for negligent maintenance or repair of the elevator. Given the evidence that the elevator had been stalled for only a few minutes and that the doorman had been contacted, there was no emergency situation necessitating plaintiff's jump from the elevator. Next is Laniox on pages 15 and 16. It's a third-party assault case. Court of Appeals, in a brief memorandum with no discussion of the facts over a dissent, held the landlord, that was New York City Housing Authority's, motion for summary judgment in this third-party assault case was properly granted. The dissenter argued the Housing Authority did not demonstrate that the assailant was not an intruder. The court wrote, the New York City Housing Authority met its initial burden of demonstrating that no material triable issues of fact exist through its showing that plaintiff's assailant was likely not an intruder. In response, plaintiff failed to adduce any admissible evidence from which a jury could conclude, without engaging in speculation, that her assailant was an intruder, and concomitantly, whether defendant's alleged negligence was a proximate cause of her injuries. So generally, where a plaintiff is trying to hold a landlord liable for an assault inside the landlord's building, obviously the usual negligence is the failure to secure the building. Generally, a landlord would not be liable unless the security was lax and an intruder came in and assailed the tenant. If it was a guest or another tenant who assaulted the plaintiff, then the proximate cause of the assault could not be lax security, and therefore the landlord could not be held liable. Next is the Carroll case, Carroll versus New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation, on page 16. It's a medical malpractice case, but it deals with the attempt to bring up a new theory of liability at the summary judgment stage. the First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the court should not have considered a new theory of medical malpractice raised for the first time in response to defendant's motion for summary judgment. The court wrote, "The complaint and bill of particulars were only sufficient to put defendant on notice of an allegation that in January 2013, he failed to properly compare the 2013 echocardiogram with the 2011 echocardiogram contained in the decedent's medical file, and to determine that a dilation in decedent's aorta had increased. Plaintiff's papers were insufficient to put defendant on notice of plaintiff's new theory of liability, raised for the first time in her expert's opinion, that he deviated from the standard of care in August 2011 when interpreting the 2011 echocardiogram." Next is Bubar, B-U-B-A-R, versus Broadman on page 17. It's a Fourth Department case, and here the Fourth Department announced a change in how the shifting burdens in a medical malpractice action should be applied. Fourth Department, reversing and modifying Supreme Court in three related appeals, clarified the respective burdens to be met at the summary judgment stage in a medical malpractice action. Applying those burdens, the Fourth Department found that summary judgment should have been awarded to the defendants in two of the three appeals. The court wrote, "It is well settled that a defendant moving for summary judgment in a medical malpractice action has the burden of establishing the absence of any departure from good and accepted medical practice, or that the plaintiff was not injured thereby." And that was a quotation from O'Shea versus Buffalo Medical Group, 64 AD 3rd, 1140, a Fourth Department case from 2009. So the court went on, "As stated in the O'Shea case, once a defendant meets that prima facie burden, the burden then shifts to the plaintiff to raise triable issues of fact by submitting a physician's affidavit, both attesting to a departure from accepted practice and containing the attesting physician's opinion that the defendant's omissions or departures were a competent producing cause of the injury." The court went on, "Upon review, we conclude that the burden that the O'Shea case places on a plaintiff opposing a summary judgment motion with respect to a medical malpractice claim is inconsistent with the law applicable to summary judgment motions in general. We therefore conclude that when a defendant moved for summary judgment dismissing a medical malpractice claim, the burden shifts to the plaintiff to demonstrate the existence of a triable issue of fact only after the defendant physician meets the initial burden, and only as to the elements on which the defendant met the prima facie burden. To the extent that O'Shea and its progeny state otherwise, those cases should no longer be followed." Next is Williams on page 18, slip and fall case, dealing with constructive notice. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the defendant's school did not demonstrate it did not have constructive knowledge of water on the floor of the cafeteria where plaintiff slipped and fell. The court said, "The school district failed to demonstrate that it did not have constructive notice of the alleged water condition that caused the plaintiff to fall. The deposition testimony of the school district's head custodian merely referred to the general cleaning and inspection practices of the custodial staff in relation to the south cafeteria of the school, but provided no evidence regarding any specific cleaning or inspection of the area in question relative to the time when the plaintiff's accident occurred." Next is Rivera on pages 18 and 19. It basically deals with late disclosure of expert witness testimony. First Department held defendant's motion to preclude plaintiff from offering his expert's report and to turn over the materials relied on by the expert was properly denied in this stairway slip and fall case. The court wrote, "Preclusion of expert evidence on the ground of failure to give timely disclosure, as called for in CPLR CPLR 3101D, is generally unwarranted without a showing that the noncompliance was willful or prejudicial to the party seeking preclusion. Prejudice can be shown where the expert is testifying as to new theories or where the opposing side has no time to prepare a rebuttal. Here, plaintiff withheld information about an expert he retained and who performed a comprehensive inspection and report before the demand for expert disclosure was served, failed to disclose this in response to such demand, and continued to withhold such information over the course of many court conferences and the years that the case was pending. He offers no excuse for his delay or for having served a response to defendant's expert disclosure demand that was arguably misleading. However, when plaintiff eventually did disclose the expert, it was not on the eve of trial. His disclosure was made on or about March 9, 2018, about 6 weeks before the originally scheduled trial date of April 30, 2018, a lead time further expanded with the court's 60-day adjournment. Moreover, notwithstanding defendants' claims to the contrary, plaintiff's expert did not advance a different theory of liability from that which the plaintiff had previously advanced. Next is Otto versus Miller on pages 19 and 20. It's another slip and fall case, this time an action against a municipality. Second Department held the town did not demonstrate that it did not receive written notice of the alleged sidewalk defect in this slip and fall case. The town's motion for summary judgment was therefore properly denied. The court wrote, while the town's Department of Public Works did not have prior written notice of the alleged defect in the sidewalk, neither the deposition testimony nor the affidavit state specifically that the town clerk's records were searched for prior written notice of the alleged defect. The town's failure to provide specific evidence that the records of both the Department of Public Works and the town clerk were searched for prior written notice constitutes a failure to demonstrate its prima facie entitlement to a judgment as a matter of law. Next is Evans versus New York Transit Authority, New York City Transit Authority, on pages 20 and 21. It's an important case because it overrules precedent in the Second Department and disagrees with the Third and Fourth Departments by finding that there need not be a motion to set aside the verdict for the appellate court to exercise its jurisdiction to weigh the weight of the evidence. The Second Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Connolly, overruling precedent and disagreeing with the Third and Fourth Departments, held, one, a party need not make a motion to set aside the verdict to be entitled to an against-the-weight-of-the-evidence review by the appellate court, and two, here, the verdict finding defendant bus driver negligent, but also finding the negligence was not the proximate cause of plaintiff's slip and fall, was against the weight of the evidence. Plaintiff stepped into a pothole when getting off the bus, which had stopped to let her off after she had missed her stop. The court wrote, a source of this court's authority to review the weight of the evidence absent a motion to set aside the verdict comes from CPLR 4404, subdivision A, the provision authorizing post-verdict motions for a new trial. CPLR 4404A provides, after a trial of a cause of action or issue triable of right by a jury, upon the motion of any party or on its own initiative, the court may order a new trial of a cause of action or separable issue where the verdict is contrary to the weight of the evidence. Insofar as the trial court is permitted to order a new trial on its own initiative, pursuant to CPLR 4404A, and the power of the appellate division is as broad as that of the trial court, this court also possesses the power to order a new trial where the appellant made no motion for that relief in the trial court. Turning to the merits, the court wrote, it was logically impossible for the jury to conclude that the bus driver was negligent in failing to provide the plaintiff with a safe location to alight from the bus, but that such negligence was not a proximate cause of the accident. It was uncontradicted that the plaintiff stepped directly from the bus into a pothole and immediately fell to the ground. Next is Ippolito versus Consolidated Edison on pages 21 and 22. It's a case involving a motion to set aside the verdict in a slip and fall. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the motion to set aside the verdict in this slip and fall case should have been granted. Although plaintiff's expert was properly qualified, his opinion that defendant's improper installation of the sidewalk slash manhole caused the sidewalk height differential over which plaintiff tripped and fell was not supported by evidence in the record. The court said the expert reached his conclusion as to the defendant's negligence by assuming material facts not supported by the evidence and by guessing and speculating in drawing the conclusion. And therefore, the motion to set aside the verdict should have been granted. Next is Operly versus Restaurant Depot on pages 22 and 23. It has to do with a slip and fall and the defendant's store's duty to its customer. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the defendant's motion for summary judgment in the slip and fall case should have been granted. Plaintiff was knocked to the floor by a shopping cart pushed by another customer in the defendant's store. Apparently, the customer had piled items high in the cart and couldn't see ahead of it. The court noted that although defendant raised this no duty to monitor customers issue for the first time on appeal, it could be considered because it raised an issue of law that could not have been avoided by the court below. The court said, an owner's duty to control the conduct of persons on its premises arises only when it has the opportunity to control such persons and is reasonably aware of the need for such control. The plaintiff contends that the defendant was negligent in failing to monitor its customers' use of the U-boat shopping carts, and more specifically, in failing to require customers to refrain from loading the carts over a certain height. However, the defendant did not owe the plaintiff a duty to protect her from the other customers' negligent use of the shopping cart because it did not have control over that customer's actions. Next is Rondazzo versus Consolidated Edison on page 23. It's a slip and fall case. This time it involves the Espinal issue of whether the defendant launched an instrument of harm and therefore could be held liable by someone who was not a party to a contract. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the actions against two contractors, MPM and VRD, which did sidewalk slash grate work, should not have been dismissed in this slip and fall case. The two contractor defendants did not demonstrate, as a matter of law, that they didn't launch an instrument of harm. The court wrote, in general, a contractual obligation standing alone will not give rise to tort liability in favor of a third party. And it cites Espinal versus Melville Snow Contractors, 98 New York 2nd, 136. Nonetheless, the Court of Appeals has recognized three exceptions to this general rule. One, where the contracting party, in failing to exercise reasonable care in the performance of his or her duties, launches a force or instrument of harm. Two, where the plaintiff detrimentally relies on the continued performance of the contracting party's duties. And three, where the contracting party has entirely displaced the other party's duty to maintain the premises safely. Here the owner, MPM, these are the contractors, here the owner and the two contractors failed to establish their prima facie entitlement to judgment as a matter of law by demonstrating that the work performed on the grate and the vault did not create the allegedly dangerous condition that caused the plaintiff to trip and fall and thus launched a force or instrument of harm. So the general principle here is that the contract between these contractors who worked on the sidewalk and Consolidated Edison usually wouldn't give rise to liability to someone who's not a party to that contract, but there are three exceptions to that. One of the exceptions is where the contractors launch an instrument of harm that caused the injury. Next is the Jackson case on page 24. It's a slip and fall case, which found that the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment should not have been granted. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held there were questions of fact about the existence of a dangerous condition, whether the defect was trivial, and proximate cause in this slip and fall case. Plaintiff allegedly fell after stepping on a loose piece of asphalt from the driveway outside of her apartment. The court wrote, plaintiff testified at her deposition that she stepped on a piece of the driveway that was maybe the size of a tennis ball. Plaintiff did not photograph or preserve the piece of asphalt that allegedly caused her to fall, and we conclude that her testimony created an issue of fact whether the alleged defect on the property was trivial and non-actionable as a matter of law. Inasmuch as plaintiff failed to establish that defendant was negligent in permitting a dangerous or defective condition to exist on the premises, she also failed to establish as a matter of law that defendant's negligence was the sole proximate cause of the accident. Plaintiff's own deposition testimony that she didn't really pay attention to the driveway or the surrounding area prior to the accident raised an issue of fact whether plaintiff's conduct was a proximate cause of the accident, inasmuch as she walked down the porch stairway onto uneven ground in the middle of the night without using due care. Next is McCabe on pages 24 and 25, another slip and fall case, this time dealing with whether a defect was trivial as a matter of law. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held there was a question of fact whether the condition of the sidewalk was a trivial defect in the slip and fall case. The edge of the sidewalk was raised less than an inch, but there was evidence the defendants themselves considered the condition of the sidewalk dangerous. The court wrote, defendants moved for summary judgment, arguing that the condition was trivial, open and obvious, and not inherently dangerous. Defendants submitted an expert affidavit, photographs, and deposition testimony. The expert concluded that the height differential in the sidewalk caused by the raised flag ranged between 7/16 of an inch and 13/16 of an inch. In opposition, plaintiff pointed to a map of the property, a budget report, her photographs, and deposition testimony. Plaintiff noted that defendant's maintenance manager had marked blue dots on a map during his inspection of the property months before her accident. The map appears to depict two blue dots in the vicinity of her fall. Plaintiff stressed that the maintenance manager testified that he marked the map with blue dots to indicate the areas where he expected that concrete repairs would be made. Plaintiff also pointed to the property's budget report, which referred to, this was months before her fall, the high priority need to repair large deteriorated sections of concrete walks and curbs. She further noted that some of her photographs depict a circle of white paint on the raised portion of the sidewalk, which she noticed immediately after her fall. Next is Robbins on pages 25 and 26. It's another slip and fall action. This time the plaintiff sued both the landlord and the tenant, alleging that a pile of stacked boxes caused the fall. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the landlord did not demonstrate it was an out-of-possession landlord in this slip-and-fall case, but the landlord did demonstrate it didn't create or have notice of the stacked boxes which allegedly caused plaintiff's slip-and-fall. The stacked boxes did not constitute an open and obvious condition as a matter of law. The court wrote, the evidence submitted by the tenant in support of its motion, including the plaintiff's deposition testimony regarding the accident, failed to eliminate all triable issues of fact as to whether the stacked boxes constituted an open and obvious condition and whether the stacked boxes constituted an inherently dangerous condition. The evidence likewise failed to establish that the tenant did not create or have notice of the condition. The landlord defendant's submissions failed to establish that they were out-of-possession landlords, The copy of the lease the landlord defendant submitted was illegible, and the deposition testimony failed to establish that the landlord defendants had relinquished control over the premises to such a degree as to extinguish their duty to maintain the premises. But the landlord defendants established their entitlement to judgment as a matter of law by demonstrating that they didn't create the alleged hazardous condition or have actual or constructive notice of the condition. So the action survived against the tenant, but not against. Next is Cespedes, C-E-S-P-E-D-E-S, versus City of New York, pages 26 and 27. It's another slip and fall case, this time against the municipality. Second Department held that the city's motion for summary judgment in this sidewalk slip and fall was properly granted. There was a clear path on the sidewalk. Plaintiff slipped and fell when she stepped backward into an area of the sidewalk which had not been cleared to avoid an unleashed dog. The court wrote, here, in opposition to the city's prima facie showing of entitlement to judgment as a matter of law, the plaintiff failed to raise a triable issue of fact as to whether the city had constructive notice of the ice condition that allegedly caused the plaintiff to fall, and whether the ice condition was unusual or dangerous. The evidence indicated that a clear path had been shoveled on the sidewalk, but that due to repeated snowstorms, snow and ice remained in the area of the sidewalk close to the street. When the plaintiff stepped backward to avoid the unleashed dog, she stepped in the area of the sidewalk closer to the street, upon which there was a 2-inch thick patch of ice. There's no evidence that the patch of ice was unusual or dangerous. Next is Coker on page 27, another slip and fall. Here the court held that a 1/2-inch defect in a step was not trivial as a matter of law. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, determined that the 1/2-inch defect in a step was not trivial as a matter of law, and also determined that the defendant did not show a lack of notice of the defect. The court wrote, a defendant seeking dismissal of a complaint on the basis that the alleged defect is trivial must make a prima facie showing that the defect is, under the circumstances, physically insignificant, and that the characteristics of the defect or the surrounding circumstances do not increase the risks it poses. Only then does the burden shift to the plaintiff to establish an issue of fact. Here the evidence attached to the defendant's moving papers indicated that there was a defect on the nosing of the step that was created by wear to the step and was approximately 1/2-inch long and extended down 1/2-inch on the riser. The alleged defective condition was located on a portion of the step where the plaintiff had to stand while twisting her body to close an exterior door. So again, that 1/2-inch defect in a step was not deemed trivial as a matter of law. Next is Burdick, page 28. It's a toxic torts case involving chemical pollution. Third Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Lynch, held that Supreme Court properly certified 4 classes to bring class action suits against a manufacturer alleging the contamination of water, air, real property, and people with the toxic chemicals PFOA and PFOS. The court wrote, plaintiffs, residents of the town, commence this action as a proposed class action alleging that defendants' use and improper disposal of PFOA and PFOS caused personal injury and property damage. In their complaint, plaintiffs proposed 4 classes. 1. A public water property damage class. 2. A private well water property damage class. And 3. A private well nuisance class. And 4. A PFOA invasion injury class. Generally, the putative class members were individuals who owned or leased property in the town, or who ingested contaminated municipal or well water, or inhaled PFOA or PFOS particulates in the town, and had demonstrable evidence of elevated levels of the chemical in their blood system. We agree with Supreme Court's determination that in addition to those questions common to the property classes, the answers to certain additional common questions will be applicable to all members of the invasion injury class. For example, 1. Whether medical monitoring is an available remedy. 2. The extent of the health hazard presented by exposure to PFOA. And 3. Whether the members of the class are at significant increased risk for disease based on the excess accumulation of PFOA in their bodies. Although defendant contends that there are myriad factual questions that are not common to the class, we do not agree that these predominate. Importantly, this is not a case where there is an issue of fact regarding exposure. Rather, each class member must establish exposure and accumulation through blood work. Next is GELO, G-E-L-O versus Meehan on page 30, traffic accident case rear-end collision. Second Department reversing Supreme Court held plaintiff was entitled to summary judgment in this rear-end collision case. The court said the plaintiff's vehicle struck the rear of the vehicle traveling directly in front of it when that vehicle made a sudden stop in response to the traffic conditions ahead. A few seconds later, the plaintiff's vehicle was struck in the rear by a vehicle operated by defendant Meehan. The court wrote, a rear-end collision with a stopped or stopping vehicle establishes a prima facie case of negligence on the part of the operator of the rear vehicle, requiring that operator to come forward with evidence of a non-negligent explanation for the collision to rebut the inference of negligence. Next is White on page 31, another traffic accident case, Fourth Department. Held defendant's motion for summary judgment was properly denied. Defendant driver, who allegedly was traveling at the speed limit, 65 miles per hour, struck a disabled car which was sideways in the left lane of a highway. The car was black, and the accident happened at night when it was raining. Defendants argued the emergency doctrine applied. The court wrote, although the accident occurred at night and the disabled vehicle was black and did not have its headlights on, the subject area of the highway was not curved and instead was straight and level with no permanent view obstructions or roadway defects to prevent defendant from perceiving the disabled vehicle. If a trier of fact determines that defendant's speed was unreasonable under the existing weather and road conditions, the trier of fact could also conclude that defendant's own unreasonable speed was what deprived him of sufficient time to avoid the collision, thereby preventing him from escaping liability under the emergency doctrine. Next is the Romaine versus City of New York case on page 32, another traffic accident case. This time the plaintiff is a passenger involved in a rear-end collision. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff passenger's motion for summary judgment in this rear-end collision case should have been granted, despite questions of fact about whether either driver was negligent. The court wrote, the right of an innocent passenger to summary judgment on the issue of whether he or she was at fault in the happening of an accident is not restricted by potential issues of comparative negligence as between two defendant drivers. It is uncontested that the injured plaintiff was a passenger seated in the rear passenger seat of the vehicle. While both drivers involved in the accident submitted affidavits in which each maintained that they were free from fault, neither driver suggested that the injured plaintiff, the passenger, bore any fault in the happening of the accident, and therefore the passenger's motion for summary judgment should have been granted. Next is Xin Fang on pages 32 and 33. It lays out the law of rear-end collisions very well. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff's motion for summary judgment in this rear-end collision case should have been granted, and it noted that a plaintiff need not demonstrate the absence of comparative fault. The court wrote, A plaintiff is no longer required to show freedom from comparative fault to establish his or her prima facie entitlement to judgment as a matter of law on the issue of liability. A driver of a vehicle approaching another vehicle from the rear is required to maintain a reasonably safe distance and rate of speed under the prevailing conditions to avoid colliding with the other vehicle. That's Vehicle and Traffic Law, Section 1129A. A rear-end collision with a stopped or stopping vehicle establishes a prima facie case of negligence on the part of the operator of the rear vehicle, thereby requiring that operator to rebut the inference of negligence by providing a non-negligent explanation for the collision. Although a sudden stop of the lead vehicle may constitute a non-negligent explanation for a rear-end collision, vehicle stops which are foreseeable under the prevailing traffic conditions, even if sudden and frequent, must be anticipated by the driver who follows. Here, the plaintiff testified at his deposition that he was reducing the speed of his vehicle with his foot on the brake pedal when his vehicle was struck in the rear by the defendant's vehicle. Likewise, the defendant's testimony at her deposition, a transcript of which was submitted by the plaintiff in support of his motion, was to the effect that her vehicle hit plaintiff's vehicle in the rear while in stop-and-go traffic. Therefore, the plaintiff established prima facie that defendant's negligence was the proximate cause of the accident. Next is Baladares on pages 33 and 34. The plaintiffs were passengers in this intersection accident case. It also raises the issue of comparative negligence. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiffs were entitled to summary judgment in this intersection traffic accident case. Plaintiffs were passengers in a car which had the right of way. Defendant may or may not have stopped at a stop sign before proceeding into the intersection. The Second Department noted that whether the defendant stopped or not was irrelevant. Although comparative negligence is generally not an issue at the summary judgment stage, it can be considered where, as here, the plaintiffs moved to dismiss defendant's comparative negligence affirmative defense. The defense obviously does not apply to innocent passengers. And here the plaintiffs were the passengers. The court wrote, to be entitled to partial summary judgment, a plaintiff does not bear the burden of establishing the absence of his or her own comparative fault. Even though a plaintiff is no longer required to establish his or her freedom from comparative negligence, the issue of plaintiff's comparative negligence may be decided in the context of a summary judgment motion where, as here, the plaintiff moved for summary judgment dismissing a defendant's affirmative defense of comparative negligence. With respect to the issue of comparative negligence, the plaintiffs demonstrated prima facie that they were innocent passengers who did not contribute to the happening of the accident. The right of the plaintiffs as innocent passengers to summary judgment is not restricted by potential issues of comparative negligence which may exist between the defendant driver and the driver of the host vehicle. Next is Smith v. Murphy on page 34. It's another rear-end collision case. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the plaintiff's motion to set aside the defense verdict in this rear-end traffic accident case should have been granted. Plaintiff was stopped when the collision occurred. The court wrote, there's no valid line of reasoning and permissible inferences that could possibly support the jury's verdict based on the evidence presented at trial. Defendant Tracy Murphy acknowledged that plaintiff's vehicle was stopped when she struck plaintiff's vehicle in the rear. Murphy's claim that plaintiff had stopped at a yellow light does not constitute a non-negligent explanation for the accident. Next is the Mast case on page 35. This deals with another traffic accident, and the issue is the amount of damages. Fourth Department, over a two-justice dissent, held that the failure to award damages for future pain and suffering and future economic loss in this back injury case was against the weight of the evidence. The motion to set aside those aspects of the verdict should have been granted. A new trial was ordered on those elements of damages. The dissenters argued the future economic loss issue was abandoned on appeal. The court wrote, the jury's failure to award any damages for future pain and suffering is contrary to a fair interpretation of the evidence and deviates materially from what would be reasonable compensation. Although the evidence at trial established that plaintiff was permitted to return to work with no restrictions, the evidence also established that the injuries she sustained in the accident severely affected her ability to perform the same sorts of tasks that she had performed with ease prior to the accident. Moreover, the party's experts agreed that the injury to plaintiff's lumbar spine was caused by the accident, and plaintiff presented uncontroverted medical testimony at trial establishing that she continues to experience pain as a result of that injury. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code that should be placed on your attorney affirmation for this November 2019 negligence update CLE. The verification code is TRAFFIC. Again, the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this November 2019 negligence update CLE is TRAFFIC. And the final case is Warren on page 36. It has to do with the interplay between a negligence litigation and the Workers' Compensation Board. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court and reinstating the negligence action, held that Supreme Court did not have jurisdiction over the matter because the Workers' Compensation Board had not yet ruled whether plaintiff was injured when acting in the scope of employment. The court wrote, although not raised by the parties, we conclude that Supreme Court erred in entertaining defendant's motion. It's well settled that primary jurisdiction with respect to determinations as to the applicability of the workers' compensation law has been vested in the Workers' Compensation Board. It is therefore inappropriate for the courts to express views with respect thereto pending determination by the board. Whether plaintiff was injured within the scope of his employment must in the first instance be determined by the board, and the court thus should not have entertained defendant's motion at this juncture. Rather, the case should have been referred to the board for a determination of plaintiff's eligibility for workers' compensation benefits. Now that concludes this November 2019 negligence update CLE.